This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. The shock, it was no shock, prevailed last summer. It may be that no one will be shocked if they prevail again, but we who live beneath the sky and view the sun and silver stars like sparks surrounding Mercury or comets nearing Mars, I'm sorry, there's no team named Mars, nor will there ever be. It would be angry, red, and male. Enough, I guess, from me. I'm joined now by Clay Callum, who covers women's basketball for Full Court Press and who'll have far less silly things to say about the WNBA, which begins its season today. Clay, welcome back to Only a Game.
Well, it's always good to be here, and I like the poetry. That's a good way to start.
You're very kind to label it that way. Let's start with the defending champion Detroit Shock, which seems to have loaded up on talent during the offseason. What changes have the Shock made?
Well, they picked up Shannon Johnson, who... a very fine point guard from San Antonio, has been on the national team, has sort of been an underachiever in her WNBA career. She may see this as a kind of redemption for her, an opportunity for her to show that, yeah, she really is a great player, and she's going to fit right in with that team. She's sort of got a chip on her shoulder, and the Shock have a chip on their shoulder, so it works out pretty well. Their big question, though, is they traded Ruth Riley to San Antonio, and they're relying on Kara Braxton, a marvelously talented 6'6 center who some nights is great and some nights, well, she's not so great. They need Kara Braxton to play well on a regular basis to be as good as they might be. But I think they're the favorites going in.
The Indiana Fever have had their moments, but never quite lived up to their potential. Some people are picking the Fever to win this year. Can they do it?
They can. They picked up Tammy Sutton Brown from Charlotte. Actually, she was a free agent, so they have a 6'5 center now that they can play. They still have Tamika Catchings. They have Tully Bevilacqua, who's a great leader in the backcourt. They picked up Cherie Sam, a veteran wing, to go along with Anna DeForge. And they won 21 games each of the last two seasons. They could certainly put it together. They're going to be a real threat. The East is going to be a very interesting race all summer long.
Well, who else would you label as a legitimate contender?
Connecticut. Lost Taj McWilliams-Franklin. She's in L.A. now. Aaron Phillips tore her ACL. I just don't know if the sun can shine that brightly. And in the West is just wide open. The West is wide open. Sacramento got to the finals last year, but they have a new coach, Jenny Busek, who's 33, and her best player, Yolanda Griffith, is 37. So you just don't know how that's going to play out. The Monarchs are a year older, but they still should be pretty good. Seattle, of course, has the marvelous Lauren Jackson, Sue Bird at guard. It's going to be a very interesting season in the West.
You didn't mention the L.A. Sparks, which could be characterized as a team falling from elite status. I guess no team losing its best player for a whole season can be expected to contend in such a competitive league.
Well, and Lisa Leslie not only was L.A.'s best player, she may have well been the league's best player. Leslie's pregnant. She's going to sit out the season. She says she's going to come back next year. But without her... L.A. certainly has a different flavor to it. Taj McWilliams-Franklin moved over from Connecticut, and she's a very fine center, a wonderful player, but she's not 6'5". She's not the shot blocker Lisa was. She's not the force on the block that Lisa was. It means that Shamiqua Holzclaw is going to have to carry the load in L.A., and Shamiqua, over the years, has had some great moments, and then there have been moments when she's just sort of faded from the scene. So there's a lot of pressure on Shamiqua. Things could happen. Michael Cooper is back as the coach, and he was the coach there when they won their two titles. So, you know, the Sparks could really take off.
Lindsey Harding was selected number one by Phoenix in this year's WNBA draft and then quickly traded to Minnesota. What, the Mercury didn't need a mercurial guard in its backcourt?
Actually, no. The Mercury have Kathy Pondexter, Kelly Miller, Diana Taurasi. They have a very good backup in Jen Derevjanik. They're very loaded in the backcourt. They pick Lindsey in the first pick knowing that they were going to trade her to Minnesota for Tangela Smith. And Tangela's a 6'5 forward center who runs the floor, and that fits right in with Paul Westhead's scheme. So Phoenix added a veteran player who can run and gun and fit right in with a team that averages 80 points a game. So I think that they knew that they were going to make that deal, and Minnesota needed a point guard desperately.
Clay, ESPN ran an article this week focusing on the experiences of Sue Bird and Diana Taurasi playing in Russia, where they are making or have made a lot more money than they've made in the WNBA, in one case 10 times as much. I thought the WNBA was the world's premier pro women's basketball league.
It's really ironic. The WNBA is by far the best league. And you play in the WNBA to set your salary scale in Europe. So you come to the WNBA and you play for $70,000, $80,000, $90,000, whatever it is, and you have a good year. And that means that the people in Europe will now pay you hundreds of thousands of dollars. If you come to the WNBA and have a bad year, the people in Europe won't pay you as much. So it is really interesting that even though the WNBA is the best league, all it does is get you more money somewhere else.
Okay, so which team takes the title in September?
Oh, geez. You know, you always do this to me, but I'm hopeful no one ever remembers what I say, but I'm going to pick the Indiana Fever. Brian Winters is a good coach. They've got inside players and outside players, and I just think that Detroit relies on an emotional edge that is really hard to maintain, and I think Indiana will surprise them in the Eastern Conference Finals, and then roll on and win the WNBA title.
Clay Callum covers the WNBA for Full Court Press. He joins me from time to time to talk women's pro hoops. Clay, thanks again.
Hey, always a pleasure, Bill.
Last Saturday, in front of a capacity crowd at BMO Field in Toronto, the newest team in Major League Soccer made history. Toronto FC won a game.
Bedlam in Canada!
Until Saturday, Toronto FC's most unhappy distinction was that the team had not only failed to win, it had failed to score. The most lopsided of their four shutout losses occurred on April 14th when the expansion club gave up four goals to the New England Revolution in Foxborough, Massachusetts. At one end of Gillette Stadium, a group of beleaguered but loud Torontonians had established a home away from home. After the game, Toronto coach Mo Johnson tried in vain to remain positive.
We can compete. Tonight, I wouldn't say it was about competing. It was a night where we were just outplayed on numerous occasions. They'd taken their goals well. We never gave our goalkeeper a chance. We get four goals scored against us. The last two were mistakes schoolboys would normally do.
That last crack notwithstanding, the Toronto roster is perhaps no more dominated by schoolboys than anybody else's. Forward Edson Buddle, a veteran of the U.S. national team, is in his seventh season with MLS. Aleko Eskandarian, late of D.C. United, was the first pick in the league's super draft in 2003. Defender Jim Brennan joined Toronto after 10 seasons in England. After playing 3 years of A-League soccer in Toronto, Marco Retta took his game to first division teams in Norway and then Denmark before coming home to Canada, where he joined 10 other Canadians on the 18-man roster. Whether for that reason or others, Toronto FC has enjoyed magnificent support in its first season, for which the team sold more than 14,000 season tickets before the first game. A circumstance that left Marco Retta mystified but delighted.
I think it's been a little bit surprising. It's been fantastic. We would have never imagined it to have this so much support. It's been great for us, and we just hope we can do a good job for their support.
You got a lot of people get upset and angry if they don't see some goals scored and some wins.
Well, I think, we welcome that. We'd rather play in front of 20,000 people than 5,000. If there's added pressure to that, then so be it.
Last Saturday night, when Toronto posted its first win by dousing the Chicago Fire 3-1, there were more than 20,000 fans at BMO Stadium. For purposes of comparison, consider that on that night Toronto was shut out in New England, the crowd numbered a little over 14,000, and that contest was preceded by a game between the World Cup-bound U.S. women's national team and Mexico. According to Cahal Kelly, who covered the first win for the Toronto Star, the fans were more than happy to finally have something about which to cheer.
Now, the atmosphere was electric. I don't think we've seen the like of it in many, many years, probably going back to Maple Leaf Gardens and to the 70s, the 60s, when when the Leafs were great and average people could afford tickets. They showered the field with cushions. It was a bad day to have a free seat cushion giveaway. Late in the game, there was a scuffle between the Toronto defender, Adam Braz, and a Chicago Fire player. They tussled in the corner a bit. The crowd started to boo. Then a fan in the far stand launched a cushion at the Chicago player, and you could see it arcing through the air forever. And finally hit him right between the shoulder blades, about 40 yards upfield. It was an amazing shot. It was probably the best pass all day.
On Wednesday night, now streaking Toronto FC scored again. One goal proved to be enough for Toronto to squeak by defending MLS champion Houston, and the only bad news for the nearly 20,000 fans who braved the rain and cold that night was that they had no cushions to throw. Had the two wins in 5 days following the four losses with which Toronto had begun the season encouraged the team's fans to expect great things? I asked Cathal Kelly.
I hesitate to use the word great, but I think they're now expecting things, which was something they weren't expecting before. I think the chemistry seems to be coming, and there's also now the suggestion that Toronto will get a designated player at some point this summer. So there's the feeling here that this team actually might compete.
Should that happy circumstance prevail, Toronto fans will be prepared. According to the company that supplies MLS apparel, Toronto fans have bought up 3 times as many team jerseys and scarves as the fans of any other team. And according to Cathal Kelly, the other team playing in Toronto this summer has cooperated magnificently in the ascension of the newest MLS team.
These are the boys of summer. The baseball club here, the Blue Jays, are going right in the tank. This is the hot ticket in Toronto. There was a bit of a groundswell when we got the club. The signing of David Beckham by LA Galaxy really helped boost our ticket sales as well. But this now is impossible. It's the hardest ticket in town to get is a ticket to Toronto FC. And just about everybody's wearing red and white in the stands.
Toronto FC hosts DC United, the team that has been plunged into last place by Toronto's recent success, this afternoon. It's 19 minutes past. I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, home is where the marathon is. But first, for several years now, Jenny Reese of the Louisville Courier-Journal has been picking the ponies for Only a Game. But until 2 Saturdays ago, when Street Sense passed 18 rivals to take the roses at the 133rd Kentucky Derby, she'd always gotten them wrong. Here to discuss her making of handicap history and to preview today's Preakness episode, the 132nd, is Jenny Reese. And I got to start by asking, what exactly went right 2 weeks ago?
Isn't that amazing? Everybody wants to talk about how Street Sense bucked history by, you know, being the first Breeders' Cup juvenile winner to win the Kentucky Derby and the first 2-year-old champion to win since Spectacular Bid in 1979. What about the streak he broke with me? Some horse if he can win when I picked him.
We got a great email from a woman who said, I was so excited you had the handicapper who had picked 10 Kentucky Derby winners in a row, because, of course, that's the way I introduced you. And I watched the Kentucky Derby, even though I'm not a sports fan, and that horse came out of nowhere and won, and it was wonderful. Boy, you people really know your stuff.
Isn't that something? We got another person hoodwinked. That's great. Somebody here in Baltimore came up to me and listens to the show and said, you know, I don't remember who you were picking over the years, but you've picked them every year. And I said, well, a little truth in advertising.
Well, tell me, Jenny, what you were thinking when Street Sense, one of 20 horses in the Derby this year, fell back to next to last place at the start.
Well, I was thinking he had a lot of horses he had to pass, but we'd seen it in the Breeders' Cup, and he got a very similar ride where he comes up on the inside, passes these horses after the fact, especially the trainer of the Hard Spun, the horse that finished second, said, how did all those jockeys let Calvin Burrell come up inside them to their left on the way to the winner's circle? And I think you got to give some credit to Calvin Burrell and the horse for making their own luck, but I'm digressing. What was I thinking? At that point, just watching the race, but then you could see, even as they were going into the second turn, the move he was making, it was like watching it in slow motion. Mm. You knew this horse was going to win. I mean, just the way he was moving. And then you start thinking, why didn't I bet more?
Well, has success gone to your head? Are you feeling pretty confident about your choice in today's race, the Preakness?
After he ended an 0 for 14 streak for me, believe me, I am not getting off this horse now. And I felt going into the Derby, the reason I did pick him was I thought he was the one horse that you knew would hit the board. And I couldn't say that about any other horse. And going into this race, I think he is strictly the one to beat. I think he's a more versatile horse. I don't think he has to come from way back. I don't think he has to come from, well, of course, there's only 9 horses in the Preakness today, so he won't be coming from any 19th. But
yeah, if he breaks 18th or 19th with in a 9-horse race, he's in real trouble.
That's right. That's right. Then that's when you think, oh, that was Jenny's pick. Right, right. I think we're going to see him coming into New York in 3 weeks with the Triple Crown on the line, and that's a whole other story there. But I also make a prediction that I say he comes on the outside in this trip, and he shows people he does not have to be on the inside to win.
Today's race, of course, marks 1 year since last year's Derby winner, Barbaro, sustained injuries in the Preakness. Eventually, the injuries led to his death. The Maryland Jockey Club has renamed the Sir Barton Stakes the Barbaro Stakes. Is this a fitting way to remember the late horse?
I think it is. And the favorite today is trained by Michael Matzie, trained Barbaro, a horse named Chiloki, who was looking at the Preakness, but I think they decided after the Derby, there's some really nice horses in the Preakness, and Chiloki's a nice horse, too, but maybe he'll try to hook them up down the road.
Are there other Barbaro-related events? There were, of course, at the Derby.
Yes, there's a tribute and ongoing fundraisers to raise money for laminitis research, which is what ultimately killed Barbaro. It was connected to the fractures in that it's a foot disease that horses often get when they are not able to, you know, when they're putting weight on their limbs for long periods of time and can't distribute their weight evenly on all their limbs.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's funny. Calvin Burrell was saying today, you know, asking him, do you think that, you know, your horse can get beat straight up, or does he have to get, you know, have traffic problems or something to get beat? And he said, the way he's doing now, he said, I don't think he can get beat. He said, you know, borrowing, like if he falls or something bad, and you think, you know, we don't even want to think about what could happen with these horses. And I think that Street Sense and this field today has been a really good anecdote, though, for the tragedy of last year. There's a lot to look forward to with these horses and with Street Sense. And he's got a couple really nice horses he's got to beat. He's got to beat Hard's Fun, who was second in the Derby, and he's got to beat Curlin, who lost for the first time when he was third in the Kentucky Derby. But those are both very serious horses. I think this is an excellent, excellent Preakness.
The dynamic of the Preakness is always interesting to me. There's never a shortage of trainers and owners who believe that they will have the best day ever and their horse will have the best day of his or her life and they can win the Kentucky Derby. But that dream kind of dies, and it's not unusual for the Preakness field to be half as big as the Derby field, is it?
That's right. Going from 20 to 9, that's about right. You're right. People start getting realistic. They paid $50,000 to run in the Derby. That's just an entry and starting fees. That doesn't count, you know, costs of hotels, let alone the very pricey Derby tickets. And I call it the $50,000 saddle tail because for most of the horses, that's what you come away with. a bunch of bills and a saddle tail that cost you $50,000. So reality hits in 2 weeks when you come to the Preakness. And it's, for one thing, the most they do start is 14, where the Derby could start a maximum of 20. But that's why you only have 4 horses coming out of the Preakness, coming out of the Derby for the Preakness, is people think, do I really think, you know, I can beat that horse? And not just having the one horse to beat, but having, you know, Hard's Fun and Curlin to beat as well.
Well, of course, the names of all these other horses notwithstanding, I feel that it's a fait accompli. I mean, Jenny Reese's horse, Street Sense, wins, and there's really no reason to argue any different.
Well, I mean, this, again, how great a horse is he if he can win when I picked him? And not just me. There's some other people like Andy Beyer, the noted handicapper with the Washington Post, picked him, and he's, you know, he picked against Seattle Slough. I mean, his record might even be worse than mine. This might be the greatest horse we've ever seen in our lifetime.
Jenny Reese calls him as she sees him for the Louisville Courier-Journal, and she calls him correctly, too. Jenny, thanks again, and good luck today.
Every 14 years. Thanks, Bill.
Jenny, can I turn to you? You give me something I can hold on to. I know you think I'm like the other people.
Tomorrow in Denver, a dozen formerly homeless men will compete in the Colorado Colfax Marathon, which has teamed up with the Denver Rescue Mission to create an innovative program that uses running to help facilitate addiction recovery. Some of these runners are improving their health and achieving goals for the first time in their lives. Nancy Greenlease has our story.
During last year's Colorado Colfax Marathon, crowds lined the race route on Colfax Avenue. They clapped wildly for participants who pounded the pavement of the city's longest street and arguably one of its seediest. Shannon Chandler stumbled upon the scene and had nothing to cheer about.
I had been up all night and was trying to score some crack.
The street is a favorite haunt of the homeless and those looking for illegal narcotics. But Chandler, a former plumber, found something else instead.
The Colfax Marathon actually kept me from my destination in order to score again. Because I had to cross Colfax, we went up and down the north side of Colfax, couldn't get across. It's just amazing that Colfax, the training for the Colfax Marathon now is keeping me healthy.
1 year later, Chandler and the other men on the Denver Rescue Mission's marathon team are running toward salvation and sobriety. Early on a recent Sunday morning, they prepare for a 20-mile training race, forming a prayer circle near the starting line.
Help us to soar like eagles, keep us injury-free, and just help us to enjoy the fellowship of the people that have come here to support us. Help us to be the light in the dark world. In Jesus' name we pray. Amen.
Amen.
Okay, ready, start. Good luck, everybody.
Runners funnel onto a dusty, desolate path and into a chilly wind. The entry fees have been waived for the men, and donations have paid for their running gear. Trainers, physical therapists, and yoga instructors have prepared them for the grueling race at no cost. All of this has made it possible for the men to train safely and properly.
Good job, good job.
Jerry Hartman makes the turn at the halfway mark, his sweat and smile glistening.
I'm doing it. We're making it. Hour 45 minutes. Not bad. All right.
Going for
more,
huh?
Yeah. All right.
Not long after, Shannon Chandler finishes, propelled by legs wrapped in ACE bandages. He's running fewer miles. Shin splints are hampering him, the result of carrying too much weight.
I love running. If it weren't for the pain, the mindset it puts you in, you just look at nature. And there isn't a drug out there I've tried that was like this. So
this high's better.
Oh, yeah. It's much better. There's no hangover tomorrow. And just a sense of accomplishment and support.
Chandler compares running to a 12-step program. The meetings are on the run with mile markers for chips. Nick Sterner is the leader of the pack. The team's captain and inspiration ran the Colfax Marathon last year while living at the Denver Rescue Mission. He says running is the perfect sport since it teaches teamwork and self-reliance.
When every guy is looking at the street the day after he walks out of this program, he's going to make that individual choice, and he's going to have that individual discipline and commitment, and that's what he's learning here.
Bobby Brewer pounds across the 20-mile finish line. His lips are open, the pain cemented on his face.
Oh, man, I think I went out too fast, because towards the end, I couldn't have no kick. I had no more kick. So I just had to keep on going. Heavenly Father just picked me up. He grabbed me by my neck and just dragged me. Because my legs wasn't doing nothing. They weren't no help.
Like many of the men running on behalf of the Denver Rescue Mission, Brewer credits his faith with helping him get sober and back in shape. He wears a Rocky Balboa-style hoodie, looking like the Golden Gloves champion boxer that he once was until his career and marriage ended. That's when he started dealing, then using drugs. Earlier this year, he had an epiphany.
Yeah, well, actually, it was the day after a pretty crazy night where myself and a guy owed me some money, kind of almost got into a shootout. We were both pulling out guns and loud talking. And the day after that, I remember sitting on my bed and just saying, dang, how'd I get in this far? I'm in too deep.
Brewer flushed the drugs and got on his knees. Soon after, he got on his feet and joined the Denver Rescue Mission's running team, discovering that running gave him more energy and zeal for life.
I mean, anywhere I go, you know, if I want to take off and run, you know, it's not unnatural for me to just go, you know, because and it feels good, you know. And once I get into a groove there, you know, after this 20 miler, you know, I'll probably be running. They'll be calling me Forrest Gump.
But not all of the runner's stories are happy ones, as Danny Graham learned before a recent training run when he sat near a teammate.
I smelled alcohol on him. It smelled like sweet, like a coconut rum. It smelled like coconut rum.
His friend was kicked off the team.
It was just kind of a major letdown that he got into drinking. He's going to end up in bad places. He's going to end up back out on the streets or, you know, something like that.
Graham says three former Denver Rescue Mission residents have died since he entered recovery. He and some teammates are calling for a reentry program for runners who stumble. On the whole, the program has succeeded, and Colfax Marathon organizers hope to expand it. One of the biggest surprises for the organizers has been the reactions of runners. Many used to sidestep around homeless men. Now they're welcoming them as fellow runners, says Colfax Marathon founder Gene Townsend.
People would come up to these guys as they were running in the public parks and ask what's going on. And they would be so inspired that they would spontaneously begin running with these guys, almost like groupies.
Shannon Chandler is pretty selective about the crowd that he'll run with. He's preparing himself for his return to Colfax Avenue tomorrow, where he'll try to score a medal instead of drugs.
I'm sure I'll see some people that are hanging around that walk the streets.
What were you saying to them?
I'd probably pick up speed.
For Only a Game, I'm Nancy Greenlace in Denver.
Teenage bear said on the day I saw my soul must be saved. Gonna take a walk down Union Square. You never know where you're gonna find it. You gotta run, 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 run. Take the dragon too. Run, 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 run. Chance of death for you. Hey, what to do?
You're listening to Only a Game. For at least as long as Barry Bonds is pursuing the home run record and George Mitchell is pursuing players and former players with invitations to testify, the discussion of steroids in Major League Baseball will not go away. But this week, one of the players who used steroids made a comment that, were it taken seriously by various players, former players, and their current or former employers, might accelerate the going away process. The player is Jason Giambi, and what he said to a USA Today reporter is, what we should have done a long time ago was stand up, players, ownership, everybody, and said we made a mistake. It is easier for Jason Giambi to suggest this than it would be for, say, Mark McGwire or Barry Bonds to do so. Giambi got caught. In sports, as in politics, often the first response of people who have not quite been caught doing something stupid or wrong is to deny everything. Sometimes the denials are preposterously silly. That doesn't matter to the people doing the denying, who are hoping that before anyone can definitively prove their stupidity or guilt, somebody else will have grabbed the attention of the public and various prosecutors and media members by doing something that's even dumber or more wrong and more photogenic. If the next Major League players involved in the steroids investigation are fortunate, on the day their names surface, Paris Hilton will emerge from jail in her birthday suit and announce that she's entering a convent. Commissioner Selig won't stand up and say, we made a mistake, because he wants to be remembered as the guy who presided over some pretty entertaining and extraordinarily lucrative baseball days, not as a duplicitous dunce who pretended to ignore the blimpification of a portion of his workforce. None of the players who use steroids are going to say, we made a mistake, because the ones who are active are still profiting from the mistake they made, which can be construed as an argument that they didn't make a mistake at all. So should Jason Giambi, who has advocated confession as the sensible first step to moving beyond the steroid swamp, be celebrated as a selfless beacon of transparency, virtue, and candor? Maybe not so fast. The same reporter to whom Giambi unburdened his soul when he said we should stand up and say we made a mistake also asked the player, so why did you take steroids? Maybe one day I'll talk about it, Giambi said, but not now. Maybe one day in a book.
I've been looking for drugs in all the wrong places. Now all I've got are disgraces, as bad, I suppose, or worse than Pete Rose.
That's right, he's had a rough time lately, but he's trying to remain positive. Positive outlook, positive attitude and positive urine test. That's right, he's had 3,000 hits, and none of them are on this album.
I shot the steroids, but
it's 22 and a half minutes before the hour.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where the program is produced. Bicon Dental Implants, offering short implants that can eliminate the need for bone grafting. Information available at Bicon.com, Bicon.com. And Indigene Pharmaceuticals, maker of Relaxane, a non-prescription product for relieving the symptoms of everyday stress. Available at Rite Aid, GNC, and Duane Reade. This is NPR, National Public.
I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, two bicycles, each of them built for one roll-along during National Bike to Work Month. But first, I'm joined by Charlie Pierce for a discussion of the week's news. Hello, Charlie.
Hi, Bill.
The Phoenix Suns were eliminated from the NBA playoffs last night by the Spurs, who, according to almost everyone except San Antonio fans, got a huge assist from the league this week. Have I got that about right?
Yeah, the Suns fell victim to some really silly strict constructionism in the interpretation of the leaving the bench rule, and lost Amari Stoudemire and Boris Diaw for a game, which really set them back. The really interesting thing about this whole series is the sudden transformation of the businesslike San Antonio Spurs into a cross between the Detroit Pistons of the Ricky Mahorn, Bill Laimbeer era, and the Manson family. They are now the least popular team in the NBA.
Ira Knubel, a reserve with the Cleveland Cavaliers, has developed a petition chastising China for that country's role in the devastation of Darfur. Isn't NBA Commissioner Stern trying to do business with China?
Hey, put up or shut up time, boys. This is something. If David Stern wants to pay as much attention to rap music as he does, maybe he can look into his own soul and realize that his league is helping, and the International Olympic Committee, who Knubel also calls out in this regard, are taking part in the ongoing genocide in Darfur, and see what he can do about it. I commend Ira Knubel for doing this. It'll be interesting to see how many of her higher profile colleagues go along with it.
The National Basketball Association has opened an office in London where the Boston Celtics and Minnesota Timberwolves will play an exhibition game on October the 10th. Why does the league need an office just to promote an exhibition game?
Because it's not going to be one exhibition game. They're expanding the fan base. There will be an NBA office in Beijing sometime in the next 5 years.
On Wednesday, tickets went on sale for the NFL game that will be played in London on October 28th in Wembley Stadium, the reconstituted Wembley. The league reportedly sold 40,000 tickets in the first 90 minutes they were available. How long before the NFL and the NBA own the entire world?
I don't know. I have never seen how American football appeals overseas. I mean, this is a one-time only fluke. They're going to get a look at the Dolphins and the Giants, which is, you know, a step up from mediocrity. It's a nice time to go to the new Wembley and see the new Wembley before they start playing actual football in it. I think this is more of a tourist attraction than anything else. You got 10,000 people coming from this country, too.
This week, attorneys for cyclist Floyd Landis attempted to portray a lab technician who had analyzed Mr. Landis's samples as, quote, inexperienced, forgetful, and incompetent. And then on Thursday, it was revealed that a man close to Landis had called Greg LeMond and pretended to be the man who had sexually abused LeMond years earlier and threatened him. Can this affair get any lower than it already is?
I never say that things like this can't get any lower, because they generally do, but it certainly can't get any stranger than this Gagan fella who called LeMond pretending to be his uncle. And apparently claimed that he was going to be in court so as to intimidate LeMond with the revelation of the secrets that LeMond eventually revealed anyway. I wouldn't want to be like one of the people who sent money to the Floyd Landis Defense Fund in the last 6 or 7 months, because you're really going to feel kind of icky when the canceled check gets back.
Ken Griffey Jr. has been playing Major League Baseball long enough to know how to deal with hecklers, and he showed an especially creative streak, I think, in handling that problem this week, don't you think?
Yeah, and he handed one of his hecklers a brand new size double XL athletic supporter.
Yeah,
which is,
everybody
know,
wants a souvenir.
Absolutely, I mean, and you know, like a cap, this is something you can wear on your head if it rains.
In the records department, a Sherpa guide named Appa climbed Mount Everest for the 17th time on Wednesday. Do you suppose he did it because it was still there?
I think he did it because he's still there. Actually, you wonder if he, you know. He gets to the North Col or something, and he says, oh, yeah, that's the rock where I sat on my 13th climb, and oh, look, there's the coat I left behind, and I knew that sandal was somewhere. Let's go over and get that, and I'll bring the rest of my oxygen down. I'll bring the rest of this power bar I ate, and I'll eat that on my 19th trip up. Does it just get boring? Does he write his name on a rock or something?
I was going to say, how long before he says, I can do this with my eyes closed?
That's right.
A gambler in Great Britain who prefers to remain anonymous picked the precise scores in 10 out of 10 soccer games last weekend. The odds of his doing this were 17,841-1, and the payoff was...
£178,000! But it didn't happen until a penalty kick enabled Liverpool to get into a draw with Charlton, thereby giving him the 2-2 score that he'd picked. He was going to tear up his slip, says the anonymous fellow, and says, you know, I was so close, I couldn't do it. As a punter, as he says, mm-hmm. I couldn't do it. So good for this anonymous British gent.
And the penalty kick to which you referred occurred in the 89th minute of that particular match. It's lovely. Charlie, I learned this week that the rules of underwater golf differ from the rules of golf as played on land. This perhaps will fail to surprise you.
This is the first underwater golf tournament was played in China this week. It's a time thing. It's how long it takes you to finish a hole and not how many shots.
Yeah.
The water, according to the spokesman of the aquarium where this match was held, the water makes the match very interesting. Not only fish and mammals distract the players, but their buoyancy makes it hard for them to stabilize themselves. Craig Stadler had very much the same problem on dry land.
And finally, Charlie, back when I was a lad, the world land speed record was challenged from time to time on the Bonneville Salt Flats, but we live in stranger times now, so talk to me of the record for world's fastest sofa.
92 miles an hour, the fastest furniture land speed record in Leicestershire this year. It's been a big week for England, actually, on our show. And this guy has this souped-up sofa, but it also has a desk with a couple of plants and tea and biscuits. So it's a very civilized way to set
Absolutely.
The land speed record.
Very civilized
but people,
way to
I hate
92.
This because people go to these things only to see a sofa crash.
Charlie Pierce writes for the Boston Sunday Globe magazine. He joins me each week at this time on Only a Game. It's an ugly image, isn't it? But thank you, Charlie.
Thanks, Bill.
If you perchance have a predilection, a penchant, or even a passion for podcasts, please proceed to onlyagame.org and press podcast. If you've noticed more bicyclists on the road than usual lately, there's a reason for that. It's National Bike to Work Week. Cyclists in Denver have to wait until June because of the threat of May snow, but commuters in Washington, D.C. were offered free bike rentals for a day. The impressively fit mayors of Taos, New Mexico, Orlando, and St. Petersburg, Florida, led rides from their neighborhoods to their respective city halls. Louisville threw a party for bicyclists, which included free valet bike parking, and a chain of gyms in Carson City, Nevada, offered free showers after the morning pedal. So, what have these bicycle commuters done to earn all these perks? Only a Game's Karen Givens cycled to Boston to find out.
Just outside a covered bike cage at the Boston University Medical Center, bicycle commuters check in for their free lunch and raffle and giveaway of those nifty Velcro ties that keep your work pants from getting caught in your bicycle chain. There are about 120 people signed up for today's luncheon, BUMC's 13th Bike Week celebration. Maureen Lacey, Director of Transcom, Transportation Solutions for Commuters, takes this opportunity to sell Bike Week t-shirts. Quite a steal at just $5.
What we did is we had these designed because the polar bears are becoming very endangered. So we have a polar bear with a helmet on a bike. Isn't that fun?
John Cook, who works in the pediatrics department at the medical center, looks like he just got off his bike. He's wearing a bright salmon-colored shirt, a bright yellow jacket, and he's rested his red bike helmet upside down on the table while he munches on his free sandwich. Cook's bike commute takes about an hour from the suburb of Arlington. Right now, he only manages it once a week, but he's trying hard to do it more often. Driving his car doesn't get him to work any faster, and his doctor wants him to get more exercise to reduce his cholesterol anyway. But anyone who's ever ridden a bike or driven a car in the city of Boston knows about the adversarial relationship between bikers and drivers. And as a commuter who does both, Cook is torn.
It's hard when you're driving a car. You just get into this mindset of going as fast as you can and trying to get there ahead of everybody else. And it makes it unsafe for bikers. When you're in a car, you expect them to get out of your way, and you don't expect to have to give them any extra room or extra space, which is crazy. Cars should be giving bikers all the space, because think of all the gasoline we're saving for those people to be using.
Michael Mallison teaches jazz band at a Jewish high school in Brookline. He's well familiar with the feeling of being on the wrong side of 2,000 pounds of metal on Boston's roadways.
Yeah, it's like being a jazz musician in a rock and roll world, or being a Jew in a Christian world, being a bicycle in a car world. We're doing the right thing, and sometimes we feel like we're in the minority. Gasoline is not the way to go. This is right for your lungs, your health, the health of the world. And I've heard that people that spin around in circles end up big wheels.
Hi.
Hello.
As the bells toll 8 on a Wednesday morning, I meet up with David Watson, executive director of MassBike, a Boston-based bicycle advocacy group, to join his morning commute.
Are you all set?
I think so, yeah.
Is your bike in good shape? Tires pumped up and everything? Okay.
We're meeting up at Watson's house because, well, my bike commute would be too easy. I could get to work almost exclusively on one of the area's river paths. And although it would be slow, dodging walkers and dogs, I'd be separated from the cars. The same is not true on Watson's ride to work.
Going 10 miles from Winchester into the financial district in downtown Boston. And the first 3.5 miles are very pretty. We're going to go along the Mystic Valley Parkway. But then we're going to hit Mass Ave in Arlington, and we are in rush hour traffic the rest of the way into Boston.
Unlike some of Boston's bicyclists, Watson knows the rules of the road, and he follows them. And before we set out, he makes sure I'm willing to do so as well.
Okay, so just a few ground rules since we haven't ridden together before.
Okay.
I do stop at all red lights and stop signs.
Okay.
We have to ride single file.
As promised, the first few miles are quiet and pretty. Most of the cars we see aren't commuters, but soccer moms in minivans taking their kids to school. But that doesn't mean there aren't hazards.
We're going to take a left here, and just watch out. There's some potholes and sand in the intersection.
Soon enough, we hit dreaded Massachusetts Avenue, the main road that goes through Arlington, Somerville, and Cambridge. Here's where we start to see Boston's notorious drivers, but also some of the city's less well-known but equally dangerous bikers, one of whom speeds past us on the left, then darts in between two rows of cars waiting at a red light and out into the intersection before the light turns green.
See, what that guy did is called splitting the lanes.
Yeah.
That's very dangerous. Weaving in and out of traffic. Totally unpredictable.
Instead, Watson suggests staying in the right lane, but not necessarily all the way to the right. He teaches me how to hold my line instead of weaving in and out of parked cars. Then, Watson suggests something which sounds a little bit crazy. As we approach a stretch of road that's too narrow for a bike and car to share the same lane, Watson explains that we're going to take the lane and make the motorists merge to the left to pass us. It sounds dangerous, but he assures me that it's less dangerous than riding in the door zone, where drivers can open their car doors without warning. And in the state of Massachusetts, Watson says, it's perfectly legal.
Okay, we gotta take the lane now.
Taking the lane does not come easy for me. I can't imagine ever being comfortable with the idea. But the traffic is stop and go, and we're moving at about the same speed as the cars anyway. To my amazement, no one honks or yells at us, and when the lane gets wider, we take our spot over to the right without incident. A few more miles into our commute near the campus of MIT, we hit a little traffic jam as we stop behind four other bicyclists waiting at a red light. Sights like this make Watson pretty happy, except for the fact that one of the riders in our little group isn't wearing a helmet, even though he has one dangling from the handlebars of his bike.
You know, while we absolutely want motorists to be on the lookout for us, you know, since we are, you know, we're not surrounded by, you know, 2,000 pounds of metal, we have to take a lot of responsibility for not putting ourselves in dangerous situations.
Which I've got to say, I see bikers doing all around us, you know.
Yeah, but, you know, it's all personal choice, but I just want to make sure that, you know, if people are doing something dangerous like that, they're making an informed decision to do it. You know, I'm not perfect. I choose to do some things I probably shouldn't do occasionally on my bike. But, you know, in general, I try just not to put myself in dangerous situations.
David Watson suggests that before trying out a bike commute on the morning of a big meeting, riders should scout out their routes with the help of bike maps and whatever other resources they can find. They should try out the ride on a weekend to look for dangerous intersections. Even as we hit the winding streets of downtown Boston, Watson knows blocks ahead of time what we're going to do next, which makes it much easier to change lanes and make turns in the crowded intersections.
This is it. This is the Mass Bike office.
Ta-da!
9.97 miles.
Through all the city has to offer.
Absolutely.
I've got to say, for all my worries, the commute wasn't so bad. No one honked at us or tried to cut us off. The route was well planned and relatively safe, and I got a beautiful early morning view of the city from the brand new bike lane on the Longfellow Bridge between Cambridge and downtown Boston. For David Watson, this commute was typical.
We talk a lot about mutual respect, and cyclists need to respect the rules of the road, and it's sort of it's sort of circular logic because, you know, motorists, who, especially if they don't know that we have a right to be on the road, are already aggravated that we're there. And I say that as someone who drives as well as rides a bike. And, you know, it infuriates me too.
Right.
If we really want respect, in some respect, we've got to earn it.
If you missed your chance to participate in National Bike to Work Week, don't worry. National Bike Month continues all through May. For Only a Game, I'm Karen Given.
Only a Game is produced by Karen Given and Gabe O'Connor. Our technical director is John Ferrati. We had help this week from Maggie Haskins. Our senior producer is Gary Wallach. To order a copy of Only a Game, call 1-800-909-9287. Toll free. CDs are $15. That's 1-800-909-9287. If you'd like to view Nancy Greenlease's marathon photo gallery, listen to stories past and present, or sign up for our newsletter, please visit onlyagame.org. Our final word comes from Toronto FC Media Communications Coordinator Michelle Lissel, who laments national differences apparent among players.
A lot of the guys, because of the Canadian-American ratio, no one's really familiar with anybody on the team.
Well, what do you expect when your roster includes people from countries that don't share a common language, heritage, or system of government? I'm Bill Littlefield. Thanks for listening. I'll see you next week.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, the Kellogg Foundation, helping people help themselves by investing in children, their families, and their communities on the web at WKKF.org. Ann and John Herman, supporting City Year and the young adults who dedicate a year of their lives to community service and leadership development, cityyear.org. And the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, helping to build a more just future for the nation and the world at macfound.org.